synthesizing arbitrary photon space in our superconducting resonator.
So thank you very much for the invitation to speak to you today about some experimental work we've been doing the past year or so, generating arbitrary photon states in a supernatant resonator with supernatant qubits. Here's our resonator, here's our qubits. Supernatant qubits are interesting. They're quantum integrated circuits where the currents and voltages are quantum. So they look like little microfabricated microwave atoms. And this synthesizing arbitrary photon states, the way I like to think about it, is the quantum version of a digital to analog converter. And you know, with conventional digital analog converters, like in your cell phone or lots of places, you have a voltage that's given by a series of bits that are weighted appropriately. And here with the quantum version of a digital analog converter, we're going to synthesize an arbitrary state with the basis of here 0, 1, 2, all the way up to 9 photons, where you define what these complex coefficients are, and then there's a deterministic protocol that then generates this arbitrary state with high fidelity. So today I'm just going to show how we do that. So we're starting just with very basic review of how these things work. They're microwave quantum systems. And you can initially think of these microwave systems in the LC oscillator, which is, of course, the resonator we're going to look at, that has a potential that's quadratic, typical for a harmonic oscillator, and these have equally spaced levels here. And, of course, you can't make a qubit out of such a system, because if you put in microwaves at this transition, you'll make all these other transitions, and you go out of your qubit state. So first thing you have to do is make a qubit to control this. And the key is to use this nonlinear inductance coming from a Josen junction, which has large nonlinearity for a single photon. So this is just a tunnel barrier with very thin aluminum oxide with two metals. This forms a nonlinear inductance, and without going, yes?
Are you saying that you also couldn't make a qubit out of a photon in a cavity?
Well, you could. The problem is you can't control it well. Well, we're going to talk about this. Let's go on, okay? So what we have is nonlinear spaced energy levels here. So now when we drive a photon into here, this is off resonance, so we stay in this 0 and 1 qubit subspace, and then you can do honest-to-God qubit operations on this. Key is this nonlinearity, which is this quadratic plus a cubic from the Josephson junction. So then to make operations here, we just, to have these two, a 0 and 1 state, we just wait for a long time so that the state just decays to the ground state, and since we're at 20 millikelvin, much less than h bar omega for 6 gigahertz, you do that with high fidelity. Then what we do is we put on a current bias. A DC value of current changes the energy separation between here and here, so that you can think of sigma z operations, and then sigma x, sigma y, you just put on an AC excitation. It's kind of like NMR, but we can change the magnetic field at our individual atoms. Then state measurement, this is kind of like field ionization. We put in a pulse current that lowers this barrier, and then if you're in the one state, you tunnel out, and you go to a state here that's classically distinguishable from this. And because this is tunneling out of here, this is very good fidelity here. And this can be measured in a few nanosecond current pulse. So we just make this using standard IC fabrication procedures for superconductors. The materials, in fact, are a little bit important. Here's the qubit. It's put in the superconducting loop. We put current here that puts flux into here, drives current around to do what make this qubit potential, and then we measure it. The circulating current here changes, which we then read with the qubit. So we have the XYZ measurement, XYZ ports for control, and then here's the readout port. And we just put this in a dilution refrigerator, lots of filters, and then some room temperature control electronics that puts pulses of microwaves and Z pulses into here. And then we just bias up the device, put in our pulses. We put a pulse of current to measure whether in the 0 or 1 state, and then you put some current through the readout squid to read out. The whole point of this, do some algorithm, You get a 0 and 1 out of each experiment. You repeat that 1,000 times to get a probability, and then you can understand what your system's doing. So here's standard, like Ravi, Lifetime, Ramsey pulses. This is the raw data of the switching probability coming out of the qubit. It's in the low to mid 90% when things are working well. This is raw data, very high probability that you're measuring it properly, and you see that you have coherence times in the hundreds of nanoseconds, and you can do operations in about 5 or 10 nanoseconds. So it's enough to do these kind of operations. Okay? So let's talk about qubits coupled to photons in the harmonic oscillator. This system has been looked at, this particular qubit coupled to photons, it looked in a lot of different experimental systems. For example, Rydberg atoms and microwaves in France, ion traps, atoms coupling to phonons. In fact, in superconducting circuits, there's been a lot of pioneering work by the Yale group. In the Yale group, they took their resonator and they read out the resonator through another linear line. What we're doing differently is we're reading out what the resonator is doing directly through our qubit. So we have our little qubit circuit here. It's weakly capacitively coupled to a lambda over 2 resonator, which is here, another capacitor. We can drive microwaves in here to change the resonator, and we can drive microwaves in here to change the qubit state, and then we can read it out through some other ports here. Of course, the physics here is we have the two-level state for the qubit. This is an adjustable transition here by the current. We have our resonator over here. And when these two systems are on resonance, you can exchange a photon from your qubit into your resonator back and forth with a frequency omega that's determined by this coupling capacitor. So typically, this is around 6 gigahertz, and this may be about 20 megahertz by choosing the appropriate capacitor. Of course, in the harmonic oscillator, you have a ladder of equally spaced levels. And if you change a photon between here and here, that's omega. But if you change a photon between here and here, or in here and here, the coupling goes up because of stimulated emission. And of course, goes as root n, as you expect for stimulated emission. So with that basic physics in mind, we can first have to calibrate the system. And what we do is we just take in a microwave pulse to our qubit, and measure whether in the 0 or 1 state. If you're off resonance, the qubit is 0, which is white here. And if it's on resonance, you'll see the probability go up but saturated about 50%. So that's what we see right here. For most of the range here, we're driving this into the qubit. This line here is when the qubit frequency is equal to our microwave frequency. That's all fine. We can adjust it with current. As I said before, it's like a D field on a nuclear spin. We can adjust that. And then here, we see this avoided level crossing. Here's a blow-up of it. And this frequency here is the frequency of our resonator. So by measuring where this frequency is, we know the resonator frequency, and from the splitting here, we know the coupling between them. So finally, what we want to do is be able to turn on and off the coupler, the coupling between the qubit and the resonator, and that's very simple, is we just have these two bias points. When we're biased here exactly on resonance, that's on coupling, and the two are talking to each other, and then if we put another current through the junction we're at here, and then we're at a few hundred megahertz away from this, and the coupling is effectively turned off. So just by going between these two points, we go between on and off. Okay, so with that in mind, we can start understanding how to generate some interesting states, interesting photon states, and we're first going to look at Fock states, which are energy eigenstates. And this is the energy level diagram of the system. Here's 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. for the harmonic oscillator. This is for the ground state of the qubit, and the excited state is, of course, this displaced by this value here. And this is for the case where the qubit frequency is slightly lower than the harmonic oscillator. So let's generate Fock states. We start in the ground state here, and the qubit and resonator in the ground state. And the first thing we're going to do is drive the qubit with microwaves, which is going to take the state from here to here, if we adjust it right, with the pi pulse. Then we get excited state in the qubit and ground state in the resonator. And then what we do is we want to swap this photon from here into the resonator, and we do that just by bringing up the current, and then these go on resonance, and if you bring it on resonance for the right amount of time, the energy will get perfectly swapped from here to here. And after these two operations, you have now created a one-state photon state, one-state Fock state. So with that in mind, you can just do it again and again, not too hard. Let's drive another microwave excitation into the qubit. Okay, then you're here, and then we bring it on resonance again, changing the current, brings on resonance, swaps over. Of course, the coupling is stronger for this photon here, so this time has to be tuned to be 1 over root 2 times this time to get this to work right. And you can keep going and going. Okay, so here's the third microwave photon, bring it on resonance, have it swap over, and now we have three states in the resonator. So at this point, we've created the three Fock state. Now we want to measure it, okay? And measuring it is very similar to how we created it, is what we do is we take the qubit and put it on resonance, and when you do that, this will swap back and forth, and the frequency of this swapping will depend on whether you're in the 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 state, etc. So by measuring the frequency of oscillation, we can determine that, so we just do the experiment over and over again, measure whether in the ground state or excited state, just measure that frequency, and then we can know if we've generated the state properly. Okay, so here's the data. We do this pump swap for 1 to 12 times. We then vary the time in which this is interacting, which is here, and this is the probability for the qubit to be in the excited state. Note this is going from about 0 to about 80 or 85%. So it's a high visibility experiment. We have big signals here. And we see a nice cosine kind of oscillation, as you would expect. And then as we go from 1 to 2 photons, the oscillation period gets faster, and the amplitude degrades a little bit, but not too bad. But you see it's getting faster and faster, as you expect. And of course it's getting faster because of this root n factor, which is stimulated emission. So that's making sense. And if you look at the 4 is about twice as fast as the 1, so it kind of scales as root n. And the big amplitude and very nice oscillations with not any weird harmonics in it. So that's, you just look at the raw data, you know things are looking pretty good. To analyze this a little bit more, what we're going to do is take the Fourier transform of this, which I plotted here, for the 12 states, and you see for the one state it's mostly at the 20 megahertz frequency, and that frequency goes up as you go to more and more Fock states, and this white line is the appropriate root n scaling, so you see that things are scaling appropriately as you expect. And you see, for example, when you're the 2 state, you're mostly in the 2, there's not really much in the 1 state, same thing in these other states, you're mostly in the Fock state that you're supposed to be in. And in fact, what you can do is you can do an analysis of this data and just say, okay, for a given state, how much probability is there for the various frequencies that correspond to the different photons? So from this data, you can actually pull out the probability of 1, 2, 3, 4 photons, etc. Okay, and that's what I'm showing here. For the 1 state, you see it's mostly 1, a little bit of 0, very little over here, kind of in the noise. 2 state, this is really big, very little here. So 2 state's kind of the best, 3's not bad. Then when you go to 5 or 6, you start seeing, picking up some other tails. But you see that the visibility of this, probability of being in the correct state is quite high. Okay, so it's really working well. And of course we can go up to 12 to some degree. Now let's talk a little bit about coherent states. We're talking about Fock states. Coherent states are, of course, even easier to produce. So all you have to do is start in the ground state of both systems and apply some kind of pulse where you vary that, say, the amplitude, and that just takes your ground state and displaces it by alpha, okay? So you create this coherent state, and then you just turn on the swap kind of operation to measure it. So put it on resonance for a variable time tau, this swaps back and forth, we measure the qubit. So here's the data, and you see this oscillates up and down like it did for the one state, But here the amplitude's low and it's a small oscillation. And then as you increase that amplitude, it gets bigger and bigger, and then you start seeing these other frequencies in here. And that makes sense because a coherent state is a superposition of many number of photons. So you expect this incoherent superposition. So this kind of looks like a mess, and there's some features here, but okay, what's really going on? The way to analyze this is to take this data and again Fourier transform it. And when you do that, you get very nice bands here. So this is the Rabi frequency, and this here is the displacement alpha. And you see nice bands here, and this corresponds, of course, to one photon, two, three, four, five, up to, I don't know, 12 or 15 or so. And if you're at a particular displacement, you'll see both the one and two state, a little bit of this three state. So you see, for each of these displacements, you see various number of photon numbers. And of course, as you go to higher displacements, the mean number gets higher and higher as you expect. So you can take a cut here and say, well, what's the amplitude of these various photons given in blue here, and the Poisson distribution is given in black. Things agree quite well. Of course, this should be a Poisson distribution. And this experiment of swapping qubit to the resonator directly allows you to determine the number of photons in that particular state. Okay? So that's kind of the basics of how this works. Now we want to talk about generating arbitrary states, which is the same basic idea, but there's some really nice subtle differences. And this is all based on a very beautiful theory paper by Law and Eberle back in 96. They're thinking about ion traps, and of course it works here. And let's just take this arbitrary initial state, 0 plus 1 plus I times 2, and let's see how to generate that state according to the Eberle protocol. The basic idea is you take this and then you work backwards to take this state and move it into the ground state, and of course quantum mechanics is reversible and we just undo that to generate the state. So to get started, here's the same energy level diagram. Now the direction of these arrows tells you the phase, and the length of the arrows tells you the amplitude right here. So this is the state. Let's decide how we're going to make that. This is some sequence of pulses. The first thing we're going to do is take this two state and get it into this state. We're trying to move the states down this ladder. So the first thing we do in this reverse engineering sequence is to put them on resonance. And if you put them on resonance for the right amount of time, then you zero out the 2G state. And then you're left with the 1E. So by putting it for the right amount of time, this happens, this goes over here. Note that you're making transitions over here, and you have to account for that, okay, so that's some calculation that we do. But the nice thing at the end, this is zeroed and we're here. So we're off resonance. Now to do the next step, we want to go from here to here, and that's just a microwave transition. And knowing this state here and this state here, you can calculate what you need to do to get this to be zero population, and you just put in that microwave pulse and you left up everything here. Of course, there's transitions here, you keep track of that, and then you just correct a little bit of phase, and then you put these on resonance again, and that takes you 1G to 0E. That's again simplifying this. So there it is, it's 0 and 1G, and then you're left with this, and then you do a microwave transition to go from the 0E to 0G state. So there you go, you're in the ground state now. And again, all you have to do is just kind of reverse this, and you can generate from the ground state this arbitrary state. Just make a point here, with all these parallel transitions going on here, you get very complicated initial states, and there's no way that we could tune this up stepwise. I mean, we just have to calibrate everything, plug in the sequence, see if it works. And hopefully, if we have the control right and we do the calculations right, it just goes up and then gets the right final state. And I wouldn't be here if it didn't work. But it's actually a pretty serious test of whether you can do these things. Okay, so let's start with some simple things. There's 1 plus 3. We generate the sequence, put it in, we get the probability of the excited state versus time, we see this oscillation. You can kind of see there are two Fourier components to this curve, and when you Fourier transform that, indeed you see that the one state and three state is about the same, very little of other states here. Now the really hard test is, let's try the state 1 plus I3. This is a different sequence, okay? But this only measures the probability of being in 1 and 3. So even though this is a different sequence, if you measure it at the end, you should get the same curve if everything is working right. And indeed, it's very, very close. Few errors here. But it really shows you that you can precisely tune things up properly. Of course, the problem is if we want to characterize the state we made, we know nothing about the phase from this experiment. Okay, so how do you get the phase? That's something that was worked out, again, for other experiments, and we just implemented it ours. Let's do something we call Wigner tomography. And I plot here the Wigner quasi-probability distribution function. And this is the case 1 plus 3. And this is in terms of conjugate variables x and p. And this is such that, for example, if you integrate over x over this way, you get psi squared of p. And if you integrate this way, you get psi squared of x. Again, that's kind of definition of the Wigner function. And what's interesting about the Wigner function is that there are negative probabilities drawn here as red. And the negative probabilities, of course, there's correlation between x and p from quantum mechanics. Now, what's very nice about the Wigner function is it's not too hard to measure with this kind of system. You create your 1 plus 3 state, and then to measure the Wigner function at a position coordinate alpha, what you do is you drive the system with an amplitude of alpha. So you displace it by alpha, and then you measure the parity of the state. And the parity of state isn't hard to measure. You just measure this this probability of E versus time, Fourier transform, get all the P's and N's that I've talked about, and then the parity is just P to the N minus N, and then that's the Wigner function. Okay? And from the Wigner function, you can also get the density matrix drawn here. And what's nice is, if you go to 1 plus I3, this is then shifted, it's rotated, and these arrows are rotated in another direction. So you can, from this, you can figure out the phase of all the wave functions. Okay? So let's do Fock state 7. Here's theory, a bunch of concentric circles because it's a symmetric state. Experiment, this is an early experiment. You see negative probabilities. Basically see the same structure here. This is not as good as we can do. It's kind of an early experiment. This is where it gets interesting. These are state 0 plus n. So here's 0 plus 1. There's a negative probability showing up there. 0 plus 2, theory, an experiment. Again, looking pretty good. 3, 4, and 5. And it's really, you know, you see all the basic details of this is you see in the experiment the basic shapes. It really matches quite good. And you can do the density matrix. This is of the different elements. The arrows is the magnitude and direction. And you see that most of the state is in the proper 0 plus n state. And there's some errors. There's some magnitude in the other state, but it's pretty small. And the fidelity of these states is about 90% or so. It's pretty good, especially considering the number of sequences you're doing here. Okay? Wigner tomography, we want to change the phase of the state. So 0, 3, 6, we change the phase of the 3 here. And you can see that these curves rotate a little bit. And if you look at the experiment, this all matches up quite well. And in the density matrices, you also see these things rotating in the correct way with all the correct elements in it. Okay? Now let's talk about the decay of these states. We generate the state, and then before we do the measurement, we just wait for a variable amount of time and then do the tomography. And this enables you to take these states and watch it decay over time and make sure that it's decaying over time. So here's the 0 plus 3 state. You can see the negative probabilities in here. Matches quite well with theory, good density matrices. And then you just watch it decay over time. So here's the movie. Here's time scales. The T1 is about 3 microseconds. So you see you lose your coherence in a few microseconds. That's 5 minutes. And everything works well. This is the theory experiment. Things look very good. You can look at those off-diagonal elements very carefully, and these are various experiments that show we can understand the diagonal elements and the off-diagonal elements, how they decay in time. You can also specifically put magnitude in an off-diagonal element and watch that decay in time sequentially. In this case, it's the nearest neighbor off the diagonal. You can see that decay in time. It all works well. So it agrees very, very well with theory. Let me show another thing here. Three-state Schrodinger cat. It's very often in these things people talk about a cat. You create a superposition of two coherent states, and you call one dead and one alive. We wanted to show off that we could do something harder, so we did a three-state Schrodinger cat. The problem is, what do you call it? Okay, so we're calling it, this is the zombie state, and this is a voodoo cat, okay? So that's what we want to generate. But let me tell you, what the point of this talk is, this might be really hard to generate with analog means. But with a digital means of generating arbitrary states, what you do is you just sit down and compute all these coefficients. It's right here. And then you digitally program those coefficients into your program, and then you'll get the state. And to do that, these are 9 states. This is the pulse sequence. We have about 36 parameters in here of the qubit pulses and the swap pulses. And there's basically 4 parameters here that you calibrate, and everything is stable enough, so even though you're putting about 36 pulses in here, it works quite well. And, okay, here it is. This is, you see the cats, and you see these lines in here that represents the coherence between these states, and you see that basic structure in the experiment. And finally, okay, we have to watch Schrodinger cat die or uncollapse. So we created an odd Schrodinger cat state. Again, here's the superposition. This would be dead and alive. You see the coherence in here. And then let's watch this over time. And as you watch this decay over time, what you basically see is not much is happening to these, but this particular structure in here is just decaying over time. And at some point at around a microsecond or so, this all decays away, and then you're just left with 2 Gaussian peaks. And that's just the classical probabilistic sum of the dead and alive cat. So it's either dead or alive probabilistically, and that's basically the depth of the coherence between the dead and alive states. And of course, at long times, this just goes to the ground state. So I'm done. No, don't do that. Okay, let me conclude. We have full quantum control over the harmonic oscillator, and we can deterministically generate arbitrary states up to about n equal 9 or so. And I believe these are the most complex states that have ever been done experimentally. It's really nice that our system has enough coherence and control that we can do that. And of course, we did it direct emitter tomography. And there's a really powerful idea here that I like. Typically, when you think about quantum systems, you're scattering photons off of atoms to understand what the atoms are doing. This experiment, you're scattering qubits off of photons to both manipulate it, control it, and to measure what's going on. It's a really different way to think about the quantum control problem. Finally, I have to credit Max and Ho-Hua. These are postdocs who did the thing. And, well, we're in California, so we have to be careful about Schrodinger cats. But this was a lot of fun, and again, thank you for the invitation to talk about this today.